Welcome to the Proceedings Podcast. I'm Bill Hamlet, the Editor-in-Chief of Proceedings at the U.S. Naval Institute. Today is Monday, March 18th, and it is a beautiful day here in Annapolis. Today's episode is brought to you by Booz Allen. Accelerate today's missions with tomorrow's technologies as the leader in providing AI solutions to the federal government and one of the world's largest cybersecurity providers. Booz Allen advances game-changing capabilities rapidly, ethically, and securely. Learn more at boozallen.com/defense. All right, today we're going to talk about one of the best books on naval strategy I've ever read. Joining me from Pennsylvania is Dr. Nick Lambert. He's the author of a new book out from the Naval Institute Press titled The Neptune Factor, Alfred Thayer Mahan and the Concept of Sea Power. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Bill.
All right, we got a lot to cover. Let's start with the influence of sea power upon history, 1660 to 1783. That book is Mahan's most famous work. So Nick, describe why he wrote it, kind of where he was in his career at the time.
Right, well, yes, it's his most famous book, certainly, but by no means his best book. And but we can come to that maybe a little bit later. So it all really begins in 1884 when Mahan, then a commander, he's captain of an old sloop called USS Wachusett, and he is deployed off South America, and it's a miserable deployment. You know, he has a very unhappy ship, and he inherited a very unhappy ship, and it's also rather dilapidated. And after a year, he wants out. So when Rear Admiral Stephen B. Luce writes to him saying, I'm setting up this new outfit called the Naval War College. Do you want to join? He leaps at the opportunity. And he's actually assigned by Luce to come up with a basic history course designed to illustrate some principles of history to provide a background for the study of naval tactics. That's really what Luce is after, naval tactics. In the process of beginning his lecture notes, he starts to see that what Luce is asking for really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And he begins to push back and saying, well, excuse me, sir, I don't think what you're trying to do here is going to work. However, Luce being the Rear Admiral and him being just recently promoted as captain, brings the hammer down and says, yeah, well, that's very interesting, Captain Mahan, but you're going to do it my way. And so he did. And he writes, what he does is that he writes a book manuscript in parallel with his lecture notes. So a lot of people seem to think they're the same, and they're not. They're written in parallel using the same data and databases, but the lecture notes are written to conform to what Luce wants him to teach, whereas the book is very much what he thinks. And what he thinks is that really this business of principles and trying to derive historical principles to come up with a workable system of steam tactics is never going to work. I suppose in general terms, the central theme of Mahan's book, the central theme is it's not all about naval combat or warfare, but rather about the relationships between trade, wealth, and power. And any of my midshipmen who hear this will remember all this because I drilled it into them several years ago. And they're probably, the mantra trade, wealth, and power, or commerce, wealth, and power, probably trigger all sorts of unhappy memories. Anyway, so once you've got this, I hate the word, but trifecta, from this he develops his concept of sea power. And he's saying that really so much depends upon context and circumstance. You cannot come up with a precise definition of sea power, if that makes sense. Rather, you can define the ingredients of sea power, or the cocktail, as it were, but the exact formula tends to vary according to circumstance. And the book, in many ways, is very, very ambitious, far too ambitious, really, for a man who doesn't have the scholarly and writing skills that he would need to write such a complex complex book. And really, the book is, in short, a hot mess. But if you want to sort of, you know, have a very simple understanding of where the difference lies between Luce and Mahan, you know, Luce is talking about governing laws, and Mahan's talking about patents. And where Luce employed dogmatism to make his point, you know, he would basically say, if you don't see things my way, then you're criminally stupid. Mahan presented a little bit more a nuance and qualification. He was much gentler in getting his message across. But most importantly, I think, is that whereas Luce is pressing for the study of how a navy fights, Mahan wanted to explain why it fights. And where Luce was trying to fathom outcomes and significance of battles, Mahan is much more interested in the outcome and significance of wars. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It also, I was interested in that opening chapter or two, the point that I think you just sort of alluded it to it there, where Luce is creating this you know, establishing this Naval War College. It's 1884. Luce had written this article about war schools, published in Proceedings. Some members of Congress, were briefed on it. They threw some money at it. They selected Luce to be the first president. And your book mentions that Luce is kind of thinking, we need to know the naval equivalent of Jaminet's theories of military tactics, right? And yes. and he sort of gives this massive task to Mahan. And when Mahan starts to dig into it, he can't find those sort of finite answers that maybe you can find in land warfare. And as you point out, he starts to gravitate more towards the why do navies fight rather than exactly how do they fight. And I think that's really interesting. And there's, you know, Mahan spends part of his time living in Newport, but as you say, there's not much there at that time. So he spends some time down in New York and New Jersey. He's kind of at a distance from the college. It's a bit of a hot mess, right? As you might imagine, you know, yeah. we sort of think of the Naval War College with its beauty and spectacle and grandeur today, but imagine what it was when, you know, Congress said, "Hey, go start this thing," right? It was, you know, a small naval station in Newport. So let's second question for you is the myth of Mahan, and so I have to admit being very guilty of this myself as a Naval Academy graduate, you know, and as a plebe, you have to memorize all the different buildings on the yard, and you see Mahan Hall and go to lectures in Mahan Hall, and you know, you hear of this, you know, the influence of sea power in history, yada yada, and that's about as deep as a midshipman or maybe as a junior officer I ever got on Mahan. And you quote, I love this, on page 10 of your book, you quote historian James Field, who once told a bunch of naval officers, quote, "having attained the status of prophet, Mahan is more praised and quoted than read," end quote. I'm guilty of that. So what are some of the major misconceptions among naval officers, not just today, but maybe over history, about Mahan's teaching, Mahan's writing?
Right. Well, first of all, I have to say it's wonderful when the interviewers actually read the book, because you actually summarized it far better than I do, which clearly shows that you read it more recently than I did.
So, I did. I absolutely read it. This was a book. Hell, once, yes. Once I got started, I was very excited about it.
Yeah. Well, how often is it that you do reading assignments for midshipmen, captains, sometimes admirals? I'm not going to mention any names. And the first thing you say is, right, have you done the reading assignment? And there's lots of guilty looks across the entire room in front of you. And they're thinking, uh-oh, I'm going to have to go to plan B pretty rapidly. So, but that isn't the case here. It's just a refreshing change, we say. Yes, the myth of Mahan. There's another famous quip that I think Geoffrey Till came up with, that Mahan actually wrote more than anyone else was prepared to read, which may be part of the problem too. He's also very difficult to understand, because you have to understand he's writing for a contemporary audience and not for today. And the ideas and the concepts, just sometimes even words, they don't automatically translate into modern English, as it were.
Yeah. Well, I'll,
I was going to say words don't speak for themselves. People like to think words speak for themselves. All you have to do is read Mahan, and that's just not going to work. You've got a great deal of the 1890s.
Right.
And he loves allusions to, I don't know, he's got metaphors, he's got allusions to contemporary results. He doesn't, or events, and he doesn't spell them out. And so he's assuming that his, which rightly so, that his audience knows what he's talking about when he's alluding to something. And of course, today, unless you know a lot of history of the 1890s, it's just going to go sailing across over the top of your head.
Yeah, I'll also point out that, you know, back in those days, we often published in Proceedings a lot of articles that were 7, 8, 10,000, in some cases 15,000 words, right? And a long feature article in today's Proceedings, this is, you know, people just write and their attention spans are shorter. But a feature article in Proceedings these days is 2,500 words, maybe 3,000. But, you know, back in those days, 3, 4, 5 times as long, right?
So. Yes.
People did. That's what they did. They wrote long and they used a lot of words.
Well, yeah, they were, and they strove for precision. And you just can't walk into Mahan and think you're going to understand what's going on. And especially with that book, that first book, it's a hot mess. Absolutely right. I mean, it's got contradictions in it. It hasn't got its terminology clearly defined. Its argument isn't all, he doesn't start the book in his introduction by saying, well, this is my main argument and these are my 3 or 4 key assumptions. He's got maybe 1 or 2 of them in there and the others are buried halfway through the text. And it's a mess. But he gets better. He gets steadily better. But back to that question you asked, is there really, I think what Mahan is seeking to do is answer the question, what's a navy for? And what he's trying to, or central in this, is he's challenging the predilection by most naval officers and navalists and naval historians since to view the subject in very basic terms, all about combat. There are 2 big problems with this, and that is, for too many officers, victory in battle translates automatically into victory in war. And to many officers, it's inconceivable, if not impossible, that this wouldn't be the case. And if it isn't, anyway, it's not their business, somebody else's problem, someone else's department. So more specifically, I would say, is what Mahan's trying to do is to, he wants the Navy to get out of the mental habit of just go at them. He talks this, the best example he cites are the famous frigate actions in the War of 1812. Which, of course, up till when he was writing, these are the most celebrated events in the history of the United States Navy. But in his assessment, their significance was next to zero in terms of achieving any strategic results. Now, he comes up with this phrase, and it recurs in a number of books and articles. He talks about the sterile glory of fighting battles merely to win them. And he's saying, but, right? We won 3 major frigate actions. What impact did it have on the course of the war? 0. So I suppose you could say is what he wants the Navy to do is to start thinking at a higher level. I would say strategy, but that word is very loaded and it wasn't in general use when he was writing, particularly in the first book. He's actually saying is there is this word called strategy, but it's an army word. And all right, we'll make allowances and borrow an army word, but it doesn't really describe what I want. So what he ends up doing is defining strategy, but what it isn't. And in the book, and maybe this is a little bit too much detail, he says, well, everybody knows what naval tactics is. Everything else other than naval tactics, we're just going to call strategy, which is a kind of negative definition. And over time, as I say, he gets more precise in what he means. But he wants the Navy to use their brain as well as their brawn to get the job done, to fight smart, as it were.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's go back a little bit to talk. I want to talk a little bit more just because both names are so famous in our Navy, and that's Mahan and Luce. And Luce was very much Mahan's boss at this point in his career as commander and as an early captain. So talk a little bit more about the relationship, Luce's influence on Mahan's early work and how over time that influence wanes and how Mahan's work changes later on, because, you know, most of our audience probably hasn't read Mahan's later books, right? So talk about how, you know, all right, so Mahan had to sort of balance what his boss wanted and what he was realizing in his research for his first book. And then later on, Luce is less of a figure for Mahan. And then he starts to develop more of this commercial power, wealth, influence view of sea power. Talk about that a little bit more.
Right. Well, I think we've already said that when it started, Luce has a very definite agenda. And when he recruits Mahan, he's got a job for him to do. And Luce was old school, which meant, he was a bit better than that, because he was prepared to listen to the opinions of his subordinates. And then he would tell them exactly what to do. That was the difference. So he was quite a progressive officer from a certain perspective. But as I say, when it comes down to it, Luce has got very clear ideas. And when there's a raft of correspondence which is showing what Mahan is saying is, I don't quite think this makes sense. And Mahan eventually says, yes, right, well, that's very interesting, but you're doing it my way. So when he's preparing his lecture notes, he does it Luce's way. But as I say, in parallel, he's got this other manuscript he's writing on the side, which are reflecting his own thoughts on the subject. And even when Luce retires from the Navy, and he remains incredibly influential. You know, for a great number of years, he has really represented a faction within the Navy that like to think of themselves as the I suppose you'd call it the fighting faction, war fighting faction. They were not particularly impressed with engineers. They weren't, there's a lot of things they weren't really impressed by. They had a number of items on their agenda, the way they wanted to see the Navy develop to reform, which played some of the odds with other factions. And the other interesting thing about Luce is that normally after the Civil War, the route to the top in the service and to gain influence within the service and beyond was through the bureaus. And Luce is the only one who never becomes a bureau chief. Mm. What he does instead is that he manages to form this faction within the Navy and develop very important political connections, especially in Rhode Island, he's of such stature and has such a sufficient following within the service that any Navy secretary has to take his opinion into consideration, or at least ask for it. Now, Mahan, of course, doesn't have any following whatsoever within the service. During this period, he very much gets seen as, I don't know, you might almost say Luce's lieutenant, his right hand. So he's seen as, you know, in slightly less polite terms, Mahan is seen as Luce's creature. This goes right the way through until the first influence book is out. He's still seen as Luce's creature. Although, even especially within the service, although it's interesting that outside of the service, he's starting to be seen as an individual and somebody who is quite different from this. And over time, when the second book comes out, which is French Revolution and Empire, which is far more readable and contains far more of the economics and the commerce that really Mahan wants to talk about. And he's also jettisoned most of the theory rubbish that he didn't really believe in, and he's dropping out a lot of Jomini and these other bits and pieces. But when that comes out in 1892, that's when he really becomes seen as a figure of considerable stature within the Navy in his own right. He's out from under Luce's shadow. And as time goes by from the 1892 onwards, and you know, he retires in, what is it, 1896, he is seen as somebody really quite significant within the Navy in his own right. And particularly Hilary Herbert, when he's Secretary of the Navy after 1894, is interested in what Mahan has to say.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that you point out by around the turn of the century, Mahan is actually a household name in the United States.
Well, he's an international figure. I mean, yeah, his movements are reported in the, you know, the social columns that he arrives back in on a liner from Europe. You know, Captain Mahan has returned to New York is written, it's in the top of the social pages. And that remains the case, and at least until, what, 1907, 1908, 1909, 1910.
Amazing.
Yes. He's probably the most famous American naval officer in history, relative to anybody else in the service at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly more famous for his academic achievements, right? And as you point out, he commanded one ship, the Wachusett, which was an old sloop in bad shape. And yeah. And he kind of ran from that command, given, you know, as soon as he was given the opportunity by Luce to leave yeah. this, what he felt was kind of an abysmal set of orders. He
wasn't out. The only one. I mean, if you looked at the situation of that squadron down there, it was pretty nasty place, very uncomfortable. The officers, you know, when he walks on board the ship, the officers say, "I'd like a transfer, please, sir." And whenever the enlisted, their term is up, they just say, "I want out and to go home." Yeah. So he's got no crew. He's got the squadron commander raiding his parts and stores. So he's got nothing there. And he tries to do his best for after a year, for about a year. Actually, 6 months, I think he'd had enough.
Yeah.
And that's miserably uncomfortable. And the weather was pretty bad. And anyway, yes, he wants out. But that wasn't his first command. He got his first command on the in 1894. 1864, during the Civil War. He was on the blockade squadron on the Texas-Florida coast.
Oh, right.
Yep. And that was a very nasty duty station as well. And again, everybody tries to get out of that. Robert Shurtleff, who is one of his contemporaries, just a little bit senior to him, there's a couple of letters in those paper where he's pulling all the strings he can to get out of that station, and I think he succeeded, and apparently everybody tried to do it. It was a hardship tour, and you do about 6 or 7 months of it, and then you were pulled out.
Where can you find the letters that your book points out, you know, tidbits from letters between Luce and Mahan? Are those at the Naval Historical and, you know, Heritage Command, or
what are they? Well, most of them. I mean, they are all over the place. Some of the, well, of course, the Naval Institute published the 3-volume series back in the 70s, edited by Doris McGuire and Robert Seeger. And so a lot of Mahan's outgoing correspondence is in there.
Got it.
And there are remarkably few mistakes. I mean, this would, you know, in any collection of letters, you expect to find errors here and there. But I only found about 2 or 3 in those. Gosh, way, and must be coming up to 2,000 pages. It's a very thoroughly done piece of work. But of course, that only gets, you know, there are other collections elsewhere. So I found 2 big collections, relatively significant collections that no one's ever actually seen before, up at Yale at Sterling Library. And those were, they're from the late 1890s in the case of Henry Farnham, and certainly from 1901, 1902 with Arthur Hadley. Now, these are the 2 of the leading economists in the United States at that time. And Mahan is personal friends with both of them. And they are teaching him what he needs to know about international economics.
Amazing.
The bulk of the collection is the the old Naval Historical Foundation collection that got deposited at the Library of Congress about 20, 30 years ago, the Royal Microfilm. But they aren't really Mahan's personal papers. What they are is when, I don't know if this is boring.
No, I think it's interesting to the historians out there, yeah.
There are, it's Captain William Pullison's collection. Mahan correspondence. Okay. So Captain William Pullison was an officer in the, he was class of 1902 from memory, And he's a captain himself in the 1930s. And he's always had an interest and an affection for Mahan, I think. I don't know whether they actually met. It's possible they did. They certainly overlapped. But anyway, there was a deliberate attack in the 1930s against Mahan's reputation as a scholar by various, they called themselves the Continentalists. We would call them isolationists today. Mm. And there's a particular, there's a very nasty article written by this Marxist historian, which appeared in, where was it? It was in Scribner's. And Captain Pulliston absolutely saw red on this and sort of decided to write a reply. And when that wasn't enough, he decided to write a biography. And this was at the time when he's Director of Naval Intelligence. So he does a three-year tour of Director of Naval Intelligence, and at the same time, he's writing in parallel a biography of Mahan. And he goes to the trouble of finding a number of Mahan's old academy classmates, his shipmates. He's got Theodore Roosevelt's wife. He talks to her. He talks to various people who worked alongside of him. And he writes to everybody he can think of saying, do you have any Mahan letters? And a lot of people write back and say, yes, we do. And so he assembled, this was his personal collection of research material, which he then decided when he finished the book to deposit with the Naval Historical Foundation, and which ends up at the, as I say, the Library of Congress. So it's sad that Mahan really wasn't very systematic in keeping his correspondence. But there's also a lot of, in the Mahan papers, there's a lot of incoming correspondence too.
Sure.
So although the Naval Institute, as I say, did an excellent job at reproducing his outgoing correspondence, there's no incoming correspondence alongside it. And you know how it is that you need sometimes to understand what Mahan is writing, you need to have seen the letter that he received, that he's reacting to.
That he's reacting to.
And so it's, well, that's just the way of the way research is done. And so they're scattered all over. There's quite, he had a lot of correspondence in the UK. So I traveled over to the UK and went through there again, various correspondence and various collections. Anyway, that's probably more information than anyone really needs to know.
Well, Nick, let's move on to Mahan and Huntington, because another famous proceedings author was Samuel B. Huntington.
Yes.
His seminal 1954 article in our pages is titled National Policy in the Transoceanic Navy, which essentially called for a power projection navy to exert military power ashore on the Eurasian landmass. The context is Cold War, Soviet Warsaw Pact, et cetera. And in many ways, you know, that's the navy that we have today. Aircraft carriers, land attack, cruise missiles, And you say that, you know, Huntington was right for the time. He was right about what he was writing about, the early Cold War. But his assumptions really didn't hold up till now, through now, right? So talk a little bit about why Huntington is now less relevant, even though it was written 50 years after Mahan, than Mahan is today.
Okay, right. Well, first of all, I have to say is I am an enormous admirer of Sam Huntington. The man was brilliant in his analysis. And when he writes this article in late 53, early 54, he just gets to the heart of the matter. And what he's saying is, okay, we've got this great big US Navy fleet, but what use is it? This is the age, but this is the atomic age. We've got nobody even on the remotest horizon who's a peer competitor to us. In fact, the second, third, and fourth, fifth, and sixth ranking navies are all technically our allies. So why do we need such a large fleet? And he, and of course, who's the obvious enemy? It's already become quite clear it's the Soviet Union. He said, well, how is the Navy going to contribute? Now, traditionally, the Navy is always seen as the shield of the Republic to prevent invasion. Well, that's just simply not going to happen. And as I said, there's no Russian fleet to speak of that needs to be dealt with. And so what's the point of it? And so it's Sam Huntington who was the architect or the originator of the whole concept of power, using the Navy as a force of power projection. And he actually flat out says is that really he's a subscriber to what you know, often gets called to today as the boots on the ground argument. He just says the only things that matter is on land. and that the Navy really is, well, it's a glorified ferry service, really. If it can adapt to become a support unit or a secure ferry service, plus provide an element of ground support within the range of its aircraft or its shore bombardment guns, that's great. But it very much relegates the Navy in national strategy to a secondary role. I think I use the phrase, you know, that it makes the Navy become the handmaiden to land power, which is quite difficult to swallow. As I say, one of the constant themes in the book is that, and this is where Mahan is absolutely emphatic, he's saying is that, you know, the sea is a completely separate domain from the land. It's a different place there. The nature and possibly even the character of war on land is very different from on sea. And I think that's just as true today.
Yeah.
And I would go further and say, as you know, cyber is a different place and space is a different place. And I wouldn't be at all surprised that if the nature and character of war in those domains as well is quite different. But anyway, to go back to Huntingdon, so Huntingdon says is that really the best thing the Navy can do is become a projection force. But he's making, and when he is saying this, it makes perfect sense. Any navalist explanation just doesn't, there's nothing that the Navy can do. But in so doing, he's making a number of very key assumptions, some implicit, some explicit. And I think there's at least three or four, depending on which he makes, he thinks the most important. But first of all, he's assuming, well, when he's writing, international trade is insignificant and relatively unimportant. I mean, less than 5% of GDP of the United States is connected to international trade. And it's even less in 1960. So the trend appears to be going down. I mean, there's nothing to trade. Russia's trade doesn't over the sea doesn't seem to really matter. So how can you generate significant pressure against the Soviet Union if there's nothing to target or no means to pressure, right?
At sea, right.
At sea. He's also assuming that the US's economic, US will remain the predominant economic power in the world and the predominant diplomatic power, the leader of the free world, I think we like to call it. He is, as I say, there's no serious adversary at sea. But he's also assuming, too, that in the principal theatre of operations, which, of course, then was seen as Western Europe, you know, the United States will have allies with big armies. Now, how many of those, I think I came up with four there, how many of those four underlying assumptions between the theory of power projection as defined by Sam Huntington still hold true today? In the principal theatre of operations, do we have allies with big armies to help out? Nope. Do we have, are we the predominant economic power? Yes, just.
Yes, but.
Maybe not in, let's say, shipbuilding.
Or purchasing power parity, or however you want to measure, right? Yep.
Let's say it's a big question mark there, and yep. It should be an absolute no contest. It should be, understand Huntington's assumption. Do we have, Are there peer competitor navies out there? Yes, there are. And then finally, does international trade matter? Well, back in his day, no, it didn't. Today, yes, absolutely it does. We're in the second phase of globalization. The first one running from around about 1870 to 1914-15. And the second one begins, well, depends on your definition, but certainly early to mid 1980s, we're in a phase of globalization. And I won't go into all the ins and outs of how we define it, but I think it can safely be stated that, yes, we're in the phase of globalization. So what that really means is that, so all of Huntington's key assumptions no longer hold true. So how can your theory of power projection hold true? You've got peer competitor navies. The Navy's admitted this for what? 7, 8, 9, 10 years? Various successive CNOs admitted we face a peer competitor.
Right.
And these are the various other assumptions. And as I say, so Huntington, of course, isn't, you know, as I say, I have to say that I am a huge admirer of his. In fact, one of the greatest mistakes in my life was involved Sam Huntington. So back in 1990, think it was 92 or 93, I got offered an Olin Fellowship at Yale and an Olin Fellowship at Harvard. And the one at Yale was under the direction of, it was a postdoctoral fellowship. Yale was connected with Paul Kennedy and the Strategic Studies Group, and John Gaddis and people like this. And there was a whole raft of people. And of course, Harvard, who was running the Olin program there, it was old Sam Huntington. And I took Yale. It was a mistake. And now I say that. I didn't appreciate and understand Huntington as well as I did. And if you have a time machine and I could borrow, I would jump in and say, nope, should have gone to Harvard.
But yeah. Anyway, but your point, Huntington's major assumptions, right, have not held true till 20.
Where now the world has changed. Funny thing is that the world that all the assumptions underpinning the strategic advice he's giving. I should put it differently. The world that exists today doesn't resemble Huntington's world of the 1950s hardly at all, and yet it looks much more like the world that Mahan was writing about in the 1890s and 1900s during the first age of globalization.
And that's the key.
Where there are multiple peer competitors, so on and so on and so forth.
Right, right. Okay, so Nick, where does this lead us? So if senior naval leaders or key members of the administration or Congress were to adopt Alfred Thayer Mahan's main theme, how would the sea services, the Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard, how would they start to change?
That's right. How do I start with this one? How would you change? Well, first of all, they'd have to define what US policy was, which would be a bit of a novelty. I think the most important thing you would have to see would be an appreciation for the value and importance of international trade over the seas, which I just don't think exists right now. The recognition and understanding just how important the global trading system is to the economic and, not just the economic well-being of America, United States, but the stability of American society and various other things. All the things that, by the way, Mahan was writing about in the 1890s of why you need a Navy and how they would be rather useful. In terms of tangible action, I think two things. First of all, it's provide a clear and coherent explanation for why navies matter to the American people and achieve buy-in from the American people. Because what's happening right now, nobody believes it, nobody buys it, and it doesn't make sense to my way of thinking. And I'll tell you what, it certainly isn't working. The other thing is, so if assuming you could get persuade the American people to contribute more to greater naval spending on the Navy. I think in terms of other tangible actions, it's greater integration of government agencies with the Navy. Because the first information, the first requirement in fighting against a competitor, or basically competing against a competitor, they don't necessarily have to be fighting, is information on how systems work, where pressure points lie. Information is king in everything. And you can't just have the Navy go get the information because there's just too much that's required. They need help from other agencies and arguably even help from certain corporations.
Right. And by information, you're talking not about intelligence about the adversary Navy. You're talking about information or intelligence about the global economic system.
Yes, part on economic data. Yeah, exactly.
Where are the trade flows? What goes where? Why does it go? How would you interdict it? What are the pressure points?
Yes.
Okay.
And you would need to, it's not just sufficient to say, well, a cargo of iron ore is, there's a trade route from South America to China, right? You would need to know what the backhaul cargoes are, various stages coming back. You would need to know who owns the ship, who owns the data requirement is enormous. And I'll stop there because I know you just signaled me we're running short of time.
Yeah. I also, when I was reading this over the weekend, I thought one of the key parallels, I guess. I read the book, I'm thinking about Mahan, I'm thinking about navies in terms of commerce and wealth generation or wealth degeneration for your adversary. Yeah. And I'm thinking about Admiral Sandy Winnefeld's American Sea Power article about mind warfare. And I thought, okay, if a Mahanian concept, a Mahanian warfare concept or focus of force structure from this book, from Mahan's work, would be mind warfare. If you believe this, you would be investing, the Navy would invest more in those capabilities, because that is that's a weapon of economic influence, economic
warfare. I completely agree. And I don't know how much, I mean, I have my own opinions on the subject, and I don't want to represent, you know, my opinions as Mahan's opinions or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I'm being sort of holding myself back and saying what I want to do. But yes, absolutely. Mines would be incredibly significant in any economic warfare campaign. So people talk about, there's the great, what's the latest fad now? It's drones. And they think all drones have to fly. Well, drones don't have to fly. Why not invest in, I don't know, submersible unmanned mine layers?
Right.
And drop a pile of intelligent mines in the South China Sea.
Yeah.
That would take care of a few problems.
Yeah, or certainly act as a significant deterrent for an economy that is a peer competitor, an economic peer competitor, right? Yeah.
The disruptive effect of having a major mine laying campaign in South China Seas or any of the entrances to or from, those cannot be underestimated.
Yeah, and that's a point that Admiral Winnefeld put in our December.
Yes, he did, and I'm saying yeah. Absolutely underlined 5 times.
Nick, this has been a great conversation. Always good to talk to you. Always great to have you on the show. My guest, Dr. Nick Lambert, he's the author of this amazing book, The Neptune Factor, Alfred Thayer Mahan and the Concept of Sea Power. Nick, congrats on a great book. And I hope it flies off the shelves. And I look forward to having more of this conversation. And hopefully you'll come down to our annual meeting, which will be here in Annapolis, in the Texas, 8th of May. That's right.
Absolutely.
For all of our listeners, if you're a member of the Naval Institute, you're welcome to come to the annual meeting. As our former CEO used to joke, the $69 or $42 for an online membership, you'll make it back in the food and drink that we serve you at the annual meeting. It's always a great event. We'll recognize the winners of 3 of our essay contests and our proceedings and Naval Institute Press and Naval History Authors of the Year. And it's a great opportunity for fellowship. Hope to see you there. Today's show is brought to you by Booz Allen. Accelerate today's missions with tomorrow's technologies as the leader in providing AI solutions to the federal government and one of the world's largest cybersecurity providers. Booz Allen advances game-changing capabilities rapidly, ethically, and securely. Learn more at boozallen.com/defense. And until next episode, remember, victory begins at the Naval Institute.